Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. For more than 14 years, Southern Oregon communities have been fighting a proposal to build a 229-mile Pacific Connector frack gas pipeline that would cross more than 400 rivers and streams on its way across Southern Oregon to the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal at the Port of Coos Bay. This past December, the Oregon Department of State Lands opened a 60-day public comment period for an important permit known as the Removal Fill Permit. For the past week, people across the state have been presenting comments on Jordan Cove's permit application at public hearings in Klamath, Jackson, Douglas, and Coos counties. Tomorrow afternoon, the final hearing will be held in Salem. Today, we talk with Allie Rosenbluth, campaigns director at Rogue Climate in Medford, Oregon, one of the organizations fighting Jordan Cove. Allie, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hi, Barbara. Thanks for having me today.
Well, it's great to have you. So you, I understand you're on your way up or in Salem now, waiting for the hearing tomorrow. Is that true?
Yeah, so I'll be in Salem tomorrow morning to help folks who are planning that rally get ready and make that happen, yeah.
Well, before we get into some background about Jordan Cove, because I do believe that there are a few listeners who might not know what it is, even though we've been talking about it here on KBOO for many years, but I just wanted to comment and get your impression. I've been seeing these very exciting photos and videos coming up from Southern Oregon for the last week with hundreds, if not 1,000 people at these meetings, most of them wearing red shirts. It's a very familiar scene. We've had a lot of hearings like that in the north, up here, this part of the Northwest. So I was wondering, what is going on? Have things changed there, or is this just what's been happening for many years and we're only just becoming aware of it now in Northern Oregon?
Yeah, so for the last week, over 3,000 people actually showed up to hearings in Klamath, Coos, Jackson, and Douglas counties. Like you said, mostly wearing red, no pipeline shirts, really coming out to speak to why they want this project stopped. And there are a lot of reasons why community members in Southern Oregon have come together over this project, whether it's tribal sovereignty, it's landowner rights, it's climate, or it's the impact of people's drinking waters. The implications of this project are so real and serious for our community members that, you know, it really makes sense that many people have come out. And I think that the growing understanding of this project and the more money that Jordan Cove is putting into advertisements is actually helping people like remind themselves that they really don't want to see this pipeline go through, and I think helped a lot to get folks out. Rogue Climate's been working to like build a movement throughout those four counties and connect people across political spectrums to come together and fight this project together, because we know we have to do that to win.
Well, I'm an old friend who grew up in Medford, and we were talking on the phone yesterday, and he was very interested in the show today, and he forwarded the email I sent out about the show to several of his friends in Southern Oregon. And he says he's very leery when he contacts any of his friends that he grew up with about political issues. But in this case, all the people he knows are really opposed to the pipeline, even though some of them might have voted for Trump. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about this kind of broad-based alliance and why so many people are upset about the pipeline. And is this actually helping to build some other kinds of bridges between different communities in Southern Oregon?
Yeah, so I really believe that's true. Like what we're seeing here, like we're seeing all across the world right now, is communities that are being exploited by a corporate interest to make a lot of money very fast and leave the impacts of this project back in communities that they don't belong in. So I think when you get down to the heart of what this issue is, people who live in these communities, despite who they voted for president, like really understand that this isn't something that benefits their community, and it's something that that is just going to make a billionaire a super billionaire, right?
Well, I wanted to just give a little bit of background for people who just moved to Oregon in the last week, maybe, or people who haven't been keeping abreast. What is Jordan Cove? It's more than just this pipeline we're talking about. It's also the first and largest LNG export facility in the Northwest, on the West Coast. Though I was just reading about the one in Kitsap, British Columbia, that's also very drawing some very virulent protests, and we might want to touch on that a little bit later on in the show. But what is Jordan Cove, and what kind of threat does it pose to Southern Oregon and to the rest of the state?
Yeah, so the Jordan Cove LNG export terminal is a proposed liquefied natural gas terminal that would export fracked gas from North America through the 229-mile-long proposed Pacific Connector pipeline overseas. So This project would cross over 400 waterways, impacting 150,000 people's public drinking water and many more private wells. It would become the largest source of climate pollution in the state of Oregon. It would impact cultural resources and burial grounds that local tribes are concerned about. And it also would require the taking of private land through the use of eminent domain. So this project was actually denied in 2016 by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which is really unheard of. It's the only project, the only pipeline that FERC has ever said no to. And that's because our communities in Southern Oregon have been so vocal about how much they don't want to see this project go through their communities, and that instead of investing more money in fracked gas, and fracked gas infrastructure, that we can build stronger, more resilient communities through transitioning to clean energy.
Now, I just want to clarify something. It was sounding a little bit unclear. The gas is going to be, you said it's being piped along this pipeline that's over 200 miles long, 229 miles to be exact. But tell us, where's the gas coming from, and how does it get to this terminal in Coos Bay?
Yeah, so like many things in Jordan Cove's application, there's a lot of missing information. So one of the things that's not 100% sure right now is where actually the gas is coming from. And we think that's actually a strategic choice of the company, because they want to tell the federal regulators that this gas is going to be coming from the United States, and it's going to, you know, really help create jobs in communities like Wyoming and Colorado, where people are seeing the impacts of fracking every day. However, we know that there is another option for the company to get gas from British Columbia. And gas in BC is actually much cheaper than the gas that is fracked in the U.S. So we think that most of the gas will actually be coming from British Columbia, but the company hasn't officially said what's going to happen with that. There was actually a statement from Pembina, which is the Canadian corporation proposing the project, a statement from them saying that they were really excited about this project because of its potential to get fracked gas from British Columbia out of North America and into markets in Asia.
And Pembina, by the way, is a Canadian company. I do believe it's based in Alberta.
Yeah.
And another interesting thing, we've been working, you know, following two big frack gas projects here in Washington State, one in Kalama, one in Tacoma. And in both cases, they had to do supplementary environmental impact statements to address upstream and downstream greenhouse gas emissions from the gas that was going to be piped. And in both of the SEISs, they made a big point about how this gas was going to be coming from British Columbia, even though originally it was supposed to be coming from Wyoming and eastern Montana. But that the reason why it was coming from British Columbia is that they have fewer methane leakage problems than they do in the United States, which actually isn't true either. So I find it kind of interesting that there's a different spin down in Jordan Cove about why gas from the United States would look better in their proposal. I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I know that there's been a lot. I mean, this project's been going on for 14 years, right? And so maybe it's just because they're slowly transitioning away from one talking point to another, right? So maybe we'll see that adapt. The company is always trying to say the thing that will make their project the most appealing to regulators, which hasn't worked in the past and hopefully won't work this year either.
Well, Ali, my engineer, Patsy Kohlberg, who's going to help me out because my voice is not working too well today, and she also has some very interesting questions. She emailed me yesterday. So I'm going to let her take over for a few moments, and she's going to ask you a little bit more technical stuff than what we've been talking about.
Yeah, hi. This is Patsy Kohlberg, and I'm part of the Healthy Climate Action Team of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I've been doing some research toward a paper that we want to write on the health effects of fracked gas. But I have actually a couple of questions, not specifically about health. And I'm just going to read you a brief statement from some of the supporters of the Jordan Cove project. Quote, specifically, the project will help to meet global market demand by providing clean burning natural gas to Asian markets, particularly Japan, which will improve the U.S. balance of trade, reduce the amount of coal-fired, oil-fired, and nuclear-powered generation currently being used in these markets, markets and increase cleaner burning energy supplies to other commercial and residential markets. Well, there's a lot there. Allie, maybe you can just deconstruct that a little bit for us.
Totally. Yeah. And first of all, I want to thank you for your work with Physicians for Social Responsibility. Oregon PSR has been a really fantastic ally in this fight. So I recognize that statement very well. It's one of the company's favorite talking points, and it is just false. So first of all, this gas isn't replacing coal in Asia. This gas is directly competing with clean energy in Asia. So no new coal plants are being built right now. They're just too expensive. It's not economically viable. Where the market really is right now is a choice between fracked gas or clean energy. So right now, if this gas was to, you know, be exported, it would be competing directly with carbon neutral energy. So that's the first thing there. And then also, the company likes to ignore a little thing called methane. You might know that methane is actually a much more potent greenhouse gas than CO2. So it's actually, I think, somewhere around 84% to 86% more potent in our atmosphere at causing warming than carbon dioxide is. So it's really, really, really important that we're not investing more in fracked gas infrastructure, and that we are investing our communities in clean energy that creates local sustainable jobs right here where we live.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Allie Rosenbluth, Campaigns Director at Rogue Climate in Medford, Oregon, one of the organizations fighting Jordan Cove.
Yeah, I just a quick follow-up question. The project was originally denied for lack of a demonstrated market for the gas, and I had read that the global market for methane had collapsed. So what has changed since that original denial, and is there a methane supply glut you know, in the global markets right now?
Yeah, so the original project was actually the second iteration of this project in 2016 was denied because the company didn't have any contracts to sell the gas. Right now, they still don't have any, like, really actually specific contracts. They have some, like, informal agreements. I think one informal agreement with a company called JERA in Japan. However, the market for LNG, there has been, like, a huge influx of LNG exports, like, throughout the world, and it's something that people, yeah, across the planet are having to fight right now to protect their communities. The other reason why the project was denied was because of how much eminent domain would have to be used. Landowners had not signed on to easements with the project, with the company, and they were really a strong piece in making sure that FERC denied this project. They're still holding on. The company is offering insane amounts of money to these people, but there's still a large, large chunk. I don't remember the percentage off the top of my head right now because it changes so frequently, but there's still a large chunk of landowners who will never sell their property and will have to be forced to eminent domain if FERC grants this permit.
Well, actually, I was reading some articles from, one was from a paper in Canyonville yesterday, and also one from the Mail Tribune in Medford talking about the hearings that you've been having. And I was struck by the real positive tone, particularly that the Mail Tribune article took in really expressing your concerns, all the concerns of the people who are opposing this project. It's very different from the media coverage up in Cowlitz County and Pierce County in Washington, where the newspapers are really aligned closely with Northwest Innovation Works and with Puget Sound Energy and the entities that are trying to push the frack gas projects up here. So I'm wondering, is this a change, or has the Mail Tribune always been giving you such a careful ear?
Yeah, the Mail Tribune has actually written multiple editorials opposing the project. So in Jackson County, we've been pretty lucky to have a news outlet that really looks at the full concerns of our community. We're not so lucky in the other counties, but we think that, you know, the more our community members, the people who are actually from that community, are talking about the project, the more journalists will come around and understand that the talking points that they're getting from the company might not be true.
It was interesting when there was a hearing in Longview a few weeks ago for the Kalama Methanol Refinery, and I was at the press box, and there were several people from the Daily News from Longview there, and Dan Sears of Columbia Riverkeeper ran up to me at one point and said, the Daily News on their website just said that the proponents of the methanol refinery are outnumbering the opponents, which was obviously not true. So I went and talked to the people there, and shortly after it became 50-50, and then by the end of the evening, the Daily News was reporting that closer to the truth, that it was like 85% to 15% opposed to the methanol refinery. But I thought it was kind of an interesting lesson for the young reporters from the Daily News to be sitting next to a gray-haired lady like me, you know, who was like sort of calling them on stuff and asking them, you know, like, why is your tally saying this and why is your website on the newspaper saying that? So I'm wondering if there's like an educational curve that can be happening. And the Canyonville paper, actually, I thought did a pretty good article the other day. What, I don't remember the name of the paper, just saw the website, but what was your thought about that?
Yeah, it's the Douglas County paper.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think what we did, because we knew that, you know, most of the journalists in our communities in, you know, rural Oregon are like right out of journalism school and, you know, are learning the ropes. So I think, you know, I do a lot of communications for the campaign. And so one thing I really try to do is make it really easy for them to have the facts. So sending out a tally, I'll have multiple people in the audience taking tallies of who spoke for, who spoke against. I think at every hearing this week, I think double the amount of people spoke against the project and spoke for, which was really exciting. And then making sure I send that to all of the reporters who I have contact with in that community has been really helpful for us to make sure that they're not using those wrong numbers like what you mentioned, because that can be really frustrating for people who turn out to those hearings and, you know, spend their time that they could be spending with family or at work, you know, speaking out against this project to get media coverage that, like, it really isn't honest to what was happening in that space can be super disempowering. So I think it's important not just for, like, having great media coverage, but also for keeping this movement excited to have those numbers in the paper.
Well, I was thinking how I think the Mail Tribune, which is a paper I got real familiar with in the early 90s during the anti-gay initiative campaign around Oregon, and that's when I think the Mail Tribune had kind of its great awakening, because they started writing some very critical articles about the Oregon Citizens Alliance and the virulent anti-gay Measure 9 that they were promoting. And so I wonder if that 27 years or so of looking beneath the surface and understanding that people will be saying one thing but really meaning another is helping them to understand the fossil fuel fight, maybe in the same way that they understood the kind of bigotry that the OCA was trying to push on the state back in the early 90s. I mean, you've actually been in Oregon for only 3 years now, but I'm sure you've heard a lot of the history of your region.
Yeah, no, I have heard a lot, and especially from the rural organizing project around that initiative right there. But I think Jackson County is a really hotbed of community opposition. Like, our Republican county commissioners all oppose the project. And so I think it also makes it really easy for the Mail Tribune to be doing good, accurate reporting on this project.
And I hope you're giving them a lot of praise and a lot of support, because sometimes it's a hard job, particularly in a small community where there's a lot of pressure. Now, I'm wondering, I guess I'm much more familiar on the day-to-day stuff of what's going on up here than I am and what's going on in Southern Oregon. But I'm wondering how much of the local governments are supporting Jordan Cove, how much of the local governments are opposing it, and what kind of interaction is there between Pembina and the pipeline company and the local governments?
Yeah, so in Jackson County, you'll see a lot of strong opposition against the project. Shitty Cove, which is a town right on the Rogue River, just downstream of where the pipeline would cross the Rogue River, actually, has passed multiple resolutions opposing the project. Unfortunately, you know, the company has a lot of money, and politicians in this day and age need a lot of money to run their campaigns. So we've seen, you know, a county commissioner race where John Sweet, who won against Katie Imons, take, I think, around $50,000 from the company, which is a lot for a small community's county commissioner race. We've also seen, Representative Reschke, who represents Klamath Falls, take a fair amount of money from the company for their campaign contributions, which actually the Oregonian reported on this summer because the questionable legality of a Canadian corporation of donating to a campaign, technically international or like out of country organizations or businesses aren't supposed to be making donations into our campaigns. So there's a really great article about that in the Oregonian that folks should take a look at if they're interested in how Jordan Cove is influencing our elections here in Oregon.
Is anybody making any legal challenges to these campaign donations?
I think that there has been some contact with the Oregon Secretary of State, but they seem to be like under capacity to respond to a lot of things. So in the works, we'll see what happens.
Well, we basically, I'm not sure we have a functioning Secretary of State right now in Oregon. So, I mean, that's a whole other story, which someday we may cover, guys. There's a lot to do with environmental issues and along with the State Lands Board. But yeah, so I don't know. It seems to me that that is a pretty serious charge. It's one of the charges they're going after the Trump campaign, for that matter.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm not sure if Canadian money is quite as dangerous looking as Russian money. But I want to remind listeners in Portland, you might remember Pembina. Because Pembina 4 years ago was trying to build a very large liquid propane terminal here in Portland, right across from Swan Island. And it fizzled because of a lot of community opposition. And unfortunately for Pembina, the neighborhood that was going to be really impacted by it was just loaded with scientists who were able to draw up blast zone maps and all kinds of stuff. But the city council and the Portland Planning Commission and, of course, the Port of Portland were behind it and almost got it passed before citizens became aware of it. So that's Pembina, this company, which actually was working behind the backs of Portland citizens. In cahoots with business, other business, and the city. It changed. That's why Portland now has a ban on any future expansion of existing fossil fuel infrastructure. But I think that Pembina is a company that's very interesting to watch. Now, they were not the original company when the FERC applications were denied in 2016. Wasn't it a different company that was running it then?
Yeah, so it was a much smaller Canadian corporation called Veresen, and after the Trump administration stepped into office, Veresen reapplied for this project because it had been previously denied, and they saw this as like a really great opportunity to sneak this project in. A few months after they reapplied, they were bought by Pembina, which is a much larger corporation, and so we've actually seen that, you know, the project was denied on its merits in 2016. So I think the company's strategy now is to try to buy our community off. You know, there's been nearly every weekend they've sent mailers to our homes, to everybody in Southern Oregon. They have TV ads and radio ads pretty much constantly. I can't walk into a bar without seeing a Pembina ad on TV, which isn't fun. But the positive side of that is that it's actually making a lot of people quite angry and making people, you know, I get a lot of emails like or calls like, hey, Allie, I saw all these advertisements and I'm so sick of them and I want to help stop this project. So it's been a really great, great moment for us to have more people join this movement. And so their strategy, their marketing strategy is, I think, really backfiring on them.
Well, actually, I was checking out one of the Facebook pages. I think it's what Southern Oregon Stop the Pipeline or something like that. And there was somebody had put up a link to a report to shareholders from Pembina saying that they were, even though they had plans of having all the approvals, the permits approved by this coming fall and moving ahead, in reality, they weren't expecting this project to actually become reality because of the tough regulatory environment in Oregon and so much, and they'd lost a lot of political support. So I was wondering, it was an interesting article to read. This is what Pembina is sending to their shareholders. So it seems like they may be giving up hope.
Yeah, so I'm not sure that's completely true. that they're giving up hope. I think that they're going to fight until, you know, they are totally, totally lost the game or have this project built. I think we've seen a lot of good things recently come through from those reports, especially that Patronus, which was one of their major investors, actually backed out of the project. We also now know that Pembina is trying to sell 40 to 60% of their stake in Jordan Cove. So that's been pretty exciting, but I think it's important to stay vigilant. And, you know, we have a really favorable federal administration to frack gas projects. And we have a governor, Kate Brown, who hasn't spoken up about this project once. So it's really important to build this political movement to stop the project and to make sure that our state agencies, which have a lot of authority to stop this project, really, really do stand up for what's best for Oregon, stand up for our clean drinking water and our climate and our beautiful, beautiful state and stop it for good.
Well, you mentioned this number. You've been fighting this for 14 years. And the people in Clatsop County in the northwest corner of Oregon fought actually the first LNG proposal. They fought it for 12 years, and they only had victory in 2016, I believe. So this is these are long battles, and I just kind of want to get a sense of what is it like to be fighting a project like this for 14 years, especially when twice you thought you'd won.
Yeah, so me personally, I have been working on this project for about 3 years, but before I moved to Oregon, I actually lived about an hour away from Cove Point, which is where the first LNG export terminal on the East Coast was built. And in college, I did a fair amount of organizing at the college I went to, talking to people about why fracking was so dangerous and what LNG was and why this terminal, Cove Point, needs to be stopped. So it's a familiar battle for me. From the people who I know who've been in it for 14 years, especially the impacted landowners, are very, very, very tired of having this take up so much time and so much of their life fighting this corporation and, you know, working as hard as they possibly can to protect their land. But I think that the hearings across Southern Oregon this week really was a boost of energy for a lot of folks. And seeing, you know, over 3,000 people across four counties, four small rural counties, was super, super, super exciting. And I think is re-energizing people. I know this movement is growing. We've seen it in so many ways. For instance, last summer, there was a Department of Environmental Quality permit that opened up, public comment period that opened up, and over 45,000 people sent in comments asking the state agency to deny this Clean Water Act permit for Jordan Cove. So this movement is building, and people across Oregon, across the Pacific Northwest, and really across North America are turning to this project and turning to Kate Brown and our state agencies and saying, hey, like, if you want to be a climate champion, stopping Jordan Cove and new fossil fuel infrastructure is what it takes.
Well, if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And today we're talking with Ellie Rosenbluth, Campaigns Director at Rogue Climate in Medford, Oregon, one of the organizations fighting Jordan Cove. I'm just thinking about the challenges of getting these liberal, climate-sounding, green-speaking politicians like Kate Brown and Governor Jay Inslee in Washington to come on board and really stand up against frack gas in the same way that they've been very vocal about coal and oil. And I know Jay Inslee is now running for president on a climate change, you know, very strong climate change platform. And I think it's time for people, I mean, people are asking him, you know, where do you stand on frack gas? How can you fit that into your agenda? And I think the same thing is true with Kate Brown. And I was talking with one of your cohorts, Stacey McLaughlin, a couple weeks ago, who's in Douglas County, and she was talking to me about some concerns about Kate Brown's future political scenario. So I wonder how, I mean, when there's so much involved in, there's so much invested in the frack gas industry and in the union connection, and these Democratic politicians are really dependent on union support to get elected. How do you kind of work your way through that conundrum?
Yeah, so I think it's really a false choice that's been set up by the fossil fuel industry, right? They're telling our communities that it's it's say yes to this project or have no job. And that is totally not true. We know that fossil fuel projects like Jordan Cove actually will destroy a lot of like good jobs in our communities. And we also know that we can create more jobs by investing in clean energy. So I think politicians like Governor Brown need to really wake up to that and, you know, start looking for opportunities for our communities to build that transition to clean energy and be that that future we need to have a safe and livable future. And, you know, stop listening to this argument that the fossil fuel industry is pushing at them.
Well, I've been talking to a lot of people in Southwest Washington about this, that if people could really figure out a way to make alliances with the unions in the way that people did when we were fighting the largest oil-by-rail terminal in Vancouver, it would have been the largest one in North America. The fight against that terminal was spearheaded by the longshoremen who would have been incinerated if there was if that thing had been built and they were caught in the middle of an oil train fire. So they understood from a very visceral way, the firefighters, I mean, there were people right on board from the beginning, not the traditional kind of alliance that we've been fighting fossil fuels. But in the frack gas projects, even the longshoremen are not, in Tacoma, they're on the side of Puget Sound Energy and building the LNG facility there. So I think some creative thinking has to, you know, be developed about how to really reach out to unions in a meaningful way, because if the unions came on board, then the Democratic leadership, I think, would come on board as well.
Yeah, and I think the longshoremen in Coos Bay, which are actually a pretty small union these days, have spoken out against Jordan Cove, especially because of the dangers that this project would bring to the community. These ships, you know, LNG tankers are the largest vessels in the ocean. They're like 3 football lengths long. And there's a really tiny bar that they would have to cross in the north spit of Coos Bay to enter the spit and to get to the terminal. And it's one of the most dangerous bars on the West Coast. So a lot of people, fishermen, people who recreate in that area are really concerned about that implication to not only the like safety and the potential of like an exploding tanker, but also their accessibility to the bar because it'll be closed down for so long while the LNG tankers are entering and exiting.
Well, actually, I've heard when I was talking with some people in Coos Bay, they talk about the incineration zone. Which is, in Tacoma, they refer to it as a blast zone, but there was something very vivid about the way they were describing this zone and the people who live in the incineration zone. What does that mean exactly, the incineration zone?
Yeah, so that is a zone that people who live within a certain radius of the terminal would see like hazardous burns if something was to go wrong at the terminal or with the tankers. So there are over 16,000 people who live in that zone, which is a really, really large amount of large population to put something as dangerous as an LNG terminal in. Like my experience on the East Coast in Cove Point, it was a much, much smaller community where this terminal went. So the like hazardous blast like wouldn't have impacted nearly as many folks as it could in Coos Bay.
Well, actually, my understanding from the work I've been doing up in Tacoma around the LNG facility there, that there's pretty stringent standards that you do not build these LNG facilities anywhere close to a major population center. And Tacoma is a bit bigger than Coos Bay, and I think the incineration or the blast zone in Tacoma includes maybe 50, 70,000 people. But Coos Bay, I mean, 16,000 people is a good part of the population of Coos Bay, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that would be most of Coos Bay and the whole city of North Bend, I'm pretty sure.
And it seems to me that that's, again, an example of, no, you would not build, this place should not be built there. Of course, there is not enough, a lovely deep water port that would be available that's not populated along the Oregon coast. So that kind of rules out having LNG on the Oregon coast, I guess. Now, I think that Patsy might have some more
points. I just wanted to add there. Also, I think it's important to like think about the potential for the Cascadia subduction zone, these tsunamis, these earthquakes, that just make another really fantastic reason why a project like this has no place on the Oregon coast.
And I think Patsy might have some more questions for you.
Yeah, I just wanted to go back a little bit to the tax revenue job stuff. These companies, big gas oil companies, always try to sell these projects to the local communities, touting the tax revenues and the job creation. And in this case, they also put out this community enhancement plan, which is talking about Jordan Cove paying $40 million a year during operations to be used for capital projects in the area. But what I find missing or hard to find from this conversation is any kind of calculation of the economic costs of these projects. And I was just wondering if anyone has tried to calculate the job loss in the agricultural or the timber or the fishing or the oyster farm industries, or any calculation of the costs of the adverse health effects, the hospitalizations, the ER visits, the lost school days, the lost job days, and of course, what kind of tax breaks these companies get. Can you speak to that in a little more detail?
Yeah, so unfortunately, there's no calculation of how much economic impact we would see from this project yet. It's something we actually have asked some research organizations, including Sightline, to take a look at, but I haven't seen any response. We know that the impact to the existing tourism industry, outdoor recreation, timber, the list you said goes on and on and on, would be huge. And definitely not worth this boom and bust cycle that Jordan Cove is proposing. When it comes to the tax revenue, yeah, so they promise a lot in tax revenue, and that excites some politicians. But it's really important to also know, like, that Jordan Cove is currently seeking a 15-year tax abatement in Coos County in attempt to pay far less than they normally would have to pay for property taxes. So I think it's just another example of this corporation trying to tell our communities that they want what's best for us and that they're trying to help us. But actually, they're only looking to make short-term profit and leave these impacts, these permanent impacts, here in Southern Oregon with our communities.
And do you have another question, Patsy? Okay, actually, I was just looking at the list you sent me, and there's one that I thought was interesting, which is the potential for this being a stranded asset.
Oh, yes, exactly.
So, Allie, that's been something that's been raised with all of these proposals, because they really seem to be being based on some pretty shaky ground, not to make a bad pun about being all in earthquake zones. but what about the possibility that they'd be a stranded asset? And we probably should define what stranded asset is.
Yeah, so a stranded asset is when a corporation, like, built something, some sort of infrastructure, and then it's totally not useful anymore, and they just let it sit there and are no longer responsible for that infrastructure. So there's a really great likelihood that this project would become a stranded asset for a lot of reasons, like whether it is because of the LNG markets and that, or whether it's because Oregon, you know, passes a great policy that really tackles climate change. There are tons of reasons why this project could become a stranded asset. And what's really concerning too is the company doesn't have any responsibility to take care of this and, like, maintain this infrastructure. It's, like, very dangerous infrastructure after they find it no longer economically viable. So that actually puts private property owners responsible for making sure that like they're taking care of this pipeline that has run through their property, right? So it's pretty wild, and
Actually, I want to back up a little bit. I hadn't really been thinking about this, but that is a big concern. I mean, this pipeline, what happens if the pipeline is decommissioned? It just stays in the ground?
Yeah, it just stays there, and it's the private property owners to deal with it.
Now, are the pipelines going to be below ground or above ground?
Mostly below ground. There'll be some points where it will be above ground.
I guess one of the concerns with, particularly with the proposals in Kalama and Longview, in Kalama and Tacoma, are that they're being proposed by LLCs, basically, limited liability corporations, which really basically means they're kind of often these, in a way, fly-by-night entities that take no legal responsibility for the messes they make. Pemban is a little bit more secure than that, isn't it?
I'm not familiar with the LLC stuff that's going on up north, so I don't want to speak on behalf of like what is more stable.
But it makes me think about all these different problems that can happen. And I guess the idea that you have these pipelines in the ground forever needing maintenance, I mean, even if they don't have gas being piped through them anymore, it seems like there could be residual gas in there. It seems like there could be all kinds of stuff. So has this been an issue that you've raised with the company?
Yeah, it's an issue that we've raised with the federal and state agencies that are permitting this project. So those are really the targets there, right? We know the company is gonna do whatever it wants to do to build this project. So the people who we are, you know, most communicating with are the regulators who get to decide whether or not this pipeline goes in the ground.
So let's talk a little bit more about this regulation process. There's the hearings right now are about the build and fill permits, and maybe we could do a little bit whatever. Did I get that right?
It's called the removal fill permit.
Okay. That's what they do in Tacoma. They build it first to get the permit later. The removal fill, I mean, it seems like it's permits that stretch the whole course of the pipeline and the kind of work that would have to be done in the estuary in Coos Bay. So what are these permits? How many are there, and how are they being addressed?
Yeah, so right now we are in the public comment period for the removal fill permit. That's with the Oregon Department of State Lands. And that public comment period will end on February 3rd. So if folks want to get comments in, they can look at the Rogue Climate website or the NoLNG.org website. And there's a lot of information about commenting there. But essentially what this permit is about is the excavating of millions of cubic yards of sediment from Oregon's waterways, wetlands, and the Coos Bay estuary. So it's about dredging and then about where all that sediment is going to go afterwards. So it's the Department of State Land's job to protect Oregon's rivers, drinking waters, climate, and local economy. So right now we're really asking Governor Kate Brown, the director of DSL, Vicki Walker, and DSL to do their job and deny removal fill permits and stop this project for good. We also, like I mentioned before, we're just in a Department of Environmental Quality public comment period, and we'll be seeing a decision from them likely around September 25th of this year. So this is another, like the removal fill permit, is a permit that if the state denies, would likely kill the project. So the Bradwood LNG terminal, which was proposed on the Columbia River, was actually the DEQ denied their Clean Water Act permit for that project, and that left that dead in the water, and it does not exist. We're also going to be seeing some federal permitting come up in the next few months. So the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will drop its draft environmental impact statement they say on February 15th. We're not sure how the current government shutdown is going to impact that and whether that's going to be pushed out or not. But that means there'll be hearings in impacted communities probably in March or May. And then in November, we would be getting a decision from them. And what's really important to know about that is when FERC makes that decision, the company then has the right to use eminent domain, and they have the easement of the whole pipeline route. So they can actually start clear-cutting these 229 miles before they even have approval from state agencies to build the project. So that's a big concern of ours, and we're hoping that state agencies and Governor Kate Brown, again, stand up and make sure that the Trump administration isn't getting to decide what happens to Oregon's private and public land and all of the really, really critical cultural resources that would be impacted by that construction.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on Cable Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. And we're talking with Allie Rosenbluth, who's campaigns director at Rogue Climate in Medford. And we're talking about fighting the Jordan Cove pipeline and very large LNG terminal that's being proposed in Coos Bay. What it looks like, actually, it looks like maybe the government shutdown might be a good thing for delaying the FERC, procedures. Because one of the things that people have raised concerns about is the Trump administration is really gung-ho on getting the Jordan Cove LNG terminal built. This is one of the big pushes they have. And I'm wondering how much excessive effort is coming from the feds to get this project built.
Yeah, so when Trump stepped into office a few days later, one of his cabinet members was quoted saying that Jordan Cove was one of their top energy priorities for the administration. We haven't heard much from them directly since then, but mostly just seeing how our federal agencies are responding to frack gas proposals across the United States. What's really interesting is that the FERC commission actually is one commissioner down right now because one of their commissioners passed away a few weeks ago. And so right now there's actually a split between pro-new frack gas pipeline builders and people who are often very pro frack gas pipelines, but also have a little bit more concerns about the use of eminent domain. So there's a split right now. And so when there's a split, a 50-50 vote on FERC, they actually don't build the project. But it's likely that we will see a new commissioner before this decision comes up. But right now it's kind of interesting. And we'll see what the new Congress and this government shutdown means for this project.
Well, how many of the commissioners that were on in 2016 who denied the permit are still on FERC?
I don't know that off the top of my head.
Any left?
I think there a lot of them have left in the last year. But yeah, I don't remember that off the top of my head.
Because I just wondered, I mean, I know that Trump got really busy appointing people, and it seemed like everybody he was appointing really is pushing frack gas.
Yeah. Definitely. He's required by statute to put, I think, two Democrats on and two Republicans on while he's in office. So I think that's how that interesting layout has evolved.
I mean, they just need to get some Democrats from Pierce County who are really pro-frack gas. That's one of the things that's been interesting in following this is how many people who are really, in a lot of ways, progressive Democrats also really support these frack gas projects for... Well, they get a lot of money from the gas industry is why.
Yeah, and I think that's just really important for everyone who is listening on the radio station right now to remember and to make sure that they are telling our governor that she needs to stand up to the Trump administration. She needs to stand up to the fossil fuel corporation that's threatening so much in Southern Oregon and so much of our climate. So if you have the chance, you should look up Governor Kate Brown's phone number and give her a ring, give her office a ring and let her know that you want her to stand up against Jordan Cove and have agencies deny permits for the project.
Well, I also, I'm just looking at how people can get engaged in really, besides going after Kate Brown, but also other ways that people can become involved in trying to stop the pipeline and the terminal from ever being built.
Yeah, so one way is to participate in the public comment periods that are happening this year. So this is a really critical year. If we're going to stop this project through state permitting, this is the year to do it. So this is the year to be engaged in public comment writing. So there are many amazing groups in Portland that have been hosting comment writing workshops and actually some comment writing plays, which I haven't gotten to see yet, but I'm really excited to eventually, that can help you write comments about this project. You can also check out nolngexports.org to see what action items we have available. There is also, of course, if you are free tomorrow between 4 and 8 p.m., going to Salem for this Department of State Lands hearing and the rally that's going to be beforehand is another great way to show your opposition to this project. Talking to your neighbors about it, spreading the word. Anything, everything is so important. We really, really, really need to be just growing this movement massively. And I think, you know, that needs to be clear to Kate Brown that she politically, it's her best move to stand up to the fossil fuel industry and stop this project, not be quiet and let it go through.
Now, it did seem there was some promise last year when Pembina was trying to get DEQ basically to just kind of let them get speed the way through the approval process and get it expedited. And the DEQ wouldn't do that. So it seemed at the time that that was a good sign. Do you think that's true? And are there been any other good signs like that?
Yeah, so that's not exactly what was happening there. What was happening is there's like a one-year clock that state agencies have around the Clean Water Act to deny permits and to have authority over federal regulators. DEQ has been doing a really, really great job sticking to that timeline and have written and released documents about how, like, what their timeline is and how they're going to fit that, so that if they do decide to deny the project, that they will have all the authority to stop it. So that's been really great. They've also sent out a bunch of other information and actually information requests to the company, because the application is so sparse of information. So they left out everything about the 600 miles of roads they would have to build to construct the pipeline. So they don't have anything around, the impact of erosion to our waterway would be for those roads. They don't have any information about landslides and pipeline construction. So DEQ just a few weeks ago actually made a really big request for the company to fill that kind of information in. And they also said in that request, like, if you don't give us this information, we're just going to assume that you're going to do the worst possible job. So that was really nice to see. And I think that's because, like, that's not just happening because that agency, you know, is super strong. It's happening because there's been so much pressure and so much communication with DEQ from community members and from people across Oregon that are like, you need to take this very, very seriously and look at these impacts and the harms to our community very seriously, and don't sell us out for this fracked gas corporation to make a bunch of money.
Well, if you want more information about the event tomorrow in Salem, we have all that information on the Locus Focus webpage, which is kboo.fm/locus-focus. And at the bottom of the description of the show today, there's a link where you can make a comment. There's information on where the event is. It's 700 Summer Street in Salem. It's just a few blocks from the state capitol, and it's at the Veterans Department building of Veterans Affairs, I think. And the bad news is that the room only holds 80 people, and I think there's going to be a lot more people than 80 people coming down. So there's another 80 people can be in the lobby, and then people are going to be outside. Fortunately, it's not going to rain, but it is going to be cold. So come dressed warm, bring all the hot beverages with you. And also, people are being urged not to carry packs, because it'll slow things down getting checked into the room. But do come down. And so if you want more information, again, go to the Locus Focus webpage for this show, and you can find out more. Anything else you'd like to add, Allie?
I just think tomorrow is going to be a ton of fun, and I hope to see a lot of you out there. I'll be there and wearing red, so make sure to wear red. It's a really important way to show opposition to this project. It's very helpful visual. So if you see me, say hi. Also, if you need help figuring out a ride share to Salem, today is the last day to do that. So if you're in Portland, you can call 503-705-1943 to get hooked up with a rideshare.
Okay. Well, it's great talking to you, Allie, and I'm looking forward to meeting you tomorrow. And then I'm going to be down in Southern Oregon next month with Allie and some other people, and be doing some more reporting directly from Jordan Cove then. So we'll have a lot more information when I come back from that trip. And this is something we will be covering quite in depth, in the same ways as we've been covering the other frack gas projects in the Northwest. Just one last thing. I'm just curious, because I've been starting to follow what's going on in British Columbia. Are you at all tied in with that struggle against the pipeline that they want to run from the frack gas formation in northeastern British Columbia to where they want to build the first LNG terminal on the West Coast?
Yeah, so it's Canada LNG, and it's proposed in Kitimat, British Columbia. We have some connections with Skeena Watershed Coalition through our executive director, Hannah's time living in British Columbia, actually. But, you know, we're really, really concerned about how the Canadian police have responded to the Unistoten camp on the Wet'suwet'en land. I'm sure many of your listeners have heard, but on Tuesday, the camp was raided violently, and these are people on their unceded territory who have been stopping dozens of pipelines for over a decade. So it's really, really important that all eyes go to Unistoten, and you know, that we are sending supplies, that we are sharing their information on the internet, and if folks are able to go up and help defend and bring whatever resources they have to that land.
Yeah, it's a bit of a haul. It's pretty far north. Kitimat's up by Prince Rupert, but it's it's an important struggle. Actually, I just saw today, I think it was either yesterday or today, there's been a blockade of a frack gas facility in eastern Canada, in Ontario, by mainly white people and settlers, as they say. But anyway, there's a big struggle there. And we got to get out of here. Anyway, it's great talking to you, Allie, and I'll see you tomorrow.
Yeah, bye.
Okay, bye-bye. I've been talking today with Allie Rosenbluth, who's the campaign's director for Rogue Climate in Medford, Oregon. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk about palm oil plantations and biofuels with Abram Lustgarten, who's a writer for ProPublica. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Robert Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Marvin Gaye. Thanks for listening.
Hey, what's up now?
Brother, what's up?
This is a big party, man.
Yeah, brother, like,
solid. Right on.